Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Today, I am back with another episode of Paso Hangouts, thanks to the Paso Robles Wine Alliance. We all love wine, and what makes wine awesome, come on, let's face it, is alcohol. But alcohol can get out of hand. Listen in as Wes Hagen, winemaker for J. Wilkes Wines, and the godfather of Paso Robles himself, Gary Eberle, talk about how wines don't need to be made in a specific way, and the high alcohol wines are on their way out. Really? I don't think so, and neither do they. In reality, balance is what makes the difference, and alcohol needs to be part of the formula to create the balanced wine. Thank you again to the Paso Robles Wine Alliance for putting this conversation together. You can find out more about them by visiting their website, pasowine.com. So you know, it's time. Let's unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle, and let's listen in as these three discuss alcohol and wine. Sláinte.
Hey everyone, I'm Chris. I'm with the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance, and we are back for another hangout, another live hangout, and this is going to be a fun one today. You'll notice that there are only three squares instead of four because I thought, you know, these two guys, as you can already see, they're already talking, they're already chatting, and this is going to be a conversation that you
know, we've been here drinking for 2 hours.
2 hours. I tried to tell Gary, I said, Gary, you know, we're going to try to keep our stories 3-4 minutes at a shot. He says, I can't say hello in 3 or 4 minutes. So, we're probably going to go long, people. So pour yourself a good glass. Keep that bottle handy because we're going to be going for a little while here. Let me go ahead and introduce who we got. We're going to have, we're just going to jump right into conversation after I introduce them because, in a way, these brands, they are iconic. So we've got Wes Hagen. He is the winemaker and brand ambassador over at J. Wilkes Wines, and he's joining us. I saw one of Wes's shows, Day Drinking with Wes. I saw that, and it was kind of the start of the thought of this show, because in the way he did it, I think I saw your very first one, actually. It popped up on my Instagram Live, and I was like, that's cool. There's no script. He's just hanging out and talking. I can do that, but I can do that with other people. So that was kind of how we started this thing. In a way, we had other ideas too, of course. And then we also have Gary Eberle of Gary Eberle. why am I introducing you now? Gary Eberle of Gary Eberle, Eberle Winery. Gary, the godfather of Paso Robles Wine Country, blah, 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 all that good stuff. You know, he's just a big, cuddly, big teddy bear is what he is. And I've invited him to be on the show today with Wes, thinking this is going to be a great conversation. What are we talking about? We're talking about alcohol, ABV, and why it matters or doesn't matter. I don't think it matters. When you have a balanced wine, it's a good wine. And that's that. Show over. No. So, that's enough. Let's drink.
I'll drink to that. As long as there's alcohol in it. It makes me feel like Lee Marvin and Cat Ballou. I'll drink to that.
So at the impetus of this show, I was talking to Wes about being on the show, and he says, hey, you know, Paso gets things ripe, and then there's this perception that, you know, all the sugar, that we have high alcohol, but we're making really balanced wines in Paso. Let's talk about that. And great idea, Wes. Thank you. And thanks for being on the show. Talk about it.
Well, you know, I am sick and tired of people telling me that wine needs to be made in a certain style. I'm sick and tired of people telling me that high alcohol wines are somehow profane, that somehow I think we got going with this in pursuit of balance thing, that the IPOB guys and women, obviously Letty Teague being an important part of that whole thing, kind of jumped in and sort of coerced or co-opted, I guess is a better word, co-opted the idea that balance means low alcohol. I think as human beings, we have been struggling for 10,000 years to make higher alcohol wines. The first wines human beings ever made were like Neolithic, kind of like Nouveau Rosé. They would have been foot stomped. The juice would have been basically fermented with whatever feral yeast was flying around from the wasps and through the sky. And you know what? They probably drank those wines wishing, gosh, I wish these could have more alcohol. Did you know that wine and wine grapes produce more disaccharide sugar than any other fruit on the planet Earth? So if you don't have a still, and remember, no European had a still until the 12th century, wine was the strongest alcoholic beverage on the planet Earth pre-distillation. No other fruit on the planet Earth produces more fermentable sugar than Vitis vinifera. So as a result, you can argue that sort of the park style, the big, rich, international style, and I am not a Robert Parker hater, and if we get into Robert Parker, I think the two greatest wine heroes in American history are probably Robert Mondavi and Robert Parker for the two absolute separate reasons. Robert Mondavi, to get people to drink fine wine at table and to use wine as a gracious part of the human lifestyle. And Robert Parker, who got people drinking fine wine in the United States, talking about fine wine, separating the wheat from the chaff, saying, you know, there's a lot of crappy wine out there, so here's some good stuff. And he hit the 82 Bordeaux on the nose, and we got rolling. So I can argue the wines I love to drink have a sense of balance that I don't necessarily find myself excited by super high extract wines. But I have been surprised so many times by wines over at or over 15% that were lovely and balanced and aged actually a lot better than I can. So again, I think to love wine, you should have an open mind. It shouldn't be like I don't drink anything but first growth and Grand Cru. I drink and I travel the world in a glass every night, whether it's an 11% Riesling or a 18.5% Greenock Creek 2015 Barossa Shiraz, Grenache. That is the world record for the highest ABV of any wine ever produced in the world. 18.5 with natural yeast. I don't know what yeast they used, but
very yeast.
Yeah. Franken yeast. That's pretty much my my feelings in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. Well, you know, to me, you know, so much of our industry changed. You know, when I came out of Davis, I've told Chris, I said, you know, we had 7 or 8 yeasts available to us, almost all of them from Scott Labs. And none of them were capable of fermenting fructose. So, I mean, you know, there was no such thing as a dry wine. You always had 5% residual. Well, now, Chris has, I swear to God, he's got 80 different yeasts that, you know, in the lab and in the big silver refrigerator that he works with. And 2/3 of them will ferment fructose. So you're getting that extra shot of the alcohol to begin with. We just had a bottle every Friday. Thursday or Friday, Chris goes to my home, goes down to my cellar, and he brings up a bottle. We started this about a year ago. And
everyone at home, it's Chris Eberle, his winemaker, not me, Chris. Just
he's not my son, my nephew, or we are not related anywhere we can find. It's just one of those fluky things. Gary Eberle, Chris Eberle, everybody assumes he's my a relative, but I'm sure somewhere back in Germany he is, but not here. But
he's too good looking to be related to you, Gary. So
no, if he was my son, he'd be handsome. But he brought up an 82 cab, and it was a sweepstakes winner at L.A. County. It was one of 5 reserves I made, although he brought the estate, not the reserve. I made 5 reserves in the 80s, and the alcohol was 12.6, and that was just fermented. Oh, where the hell did you get that?
Oh, you know, I got things.
Holy shit. Okay. That was my 82-12-6. Yeah. And that's fermented complete. Well, it was from, there was no fermentable sugar because we were using Pasteur Red yeast at that time, and Pasteur Red would not ferment the fructose. If I had been using one of Chris's, the alcohol now would have been about 13.3. 13.2, 13.3. So the evolution of these, and people say, why do you use these new yeasts? Well, Pasteur Red, man, it generated hydrogen sulfide like you can't believe. It had, I mean, there were so many downsides to it. And now you get these new yeasts, and they will take, and I say, Chris, what the hell are you using 26 yeasts for this year? Because each one, he'll ferment three different lots of, you know, Viognier or Cabernet with three different yeasts in different tanks, and you get different characteristics, and then you blend them together. And I think it's one of the reasons that we saw in the late 90s, early 2000s, such a really significant jump in the quality of the California and the industry winemaking overall, because the bugs we got to work with are so much better. You know, I remember back in the 70s, oh, don't touch your face, Gary. You don't know where my finger's been. you know, when Bob Travers first started coming out with these up on Black Thomas Mountain, he started coming up with these big high alcohol zins, and, you know, almost everybody we kind of, you know, looked at them and went, oh, man. But it was Zinfandel. It's easier to get high up on Zin. And then all of a sudden, our industry, towards the middle of the 80s, and I don't want to say Robert Parker didn't have an influence, because I think he did, but it wasn't just Mr. Parker, started chasing higher alcohol. And I mean, I've had Zinfandels. I didn't make them. But, I mean, it was Zinfandels that had so much alcohol that if you didn't like them, you can use them as a bathroom disinfectant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, frequently hot. But, you know, at the same time, Zinfandel was a good wine to use because one of the things that covers up hot and covers up alcohol is fruit. And that's why I think the Viogniers at 15.5 alcohol, because of the fruit is there. Fruit covers up alcohol. It covers up a whole lot of alcohol.
Now, do you think, Gary, when those wines start to lose their baby fat and they get 3 to 5 years in the bottle, do you think those wines that were saved by the extract, when the extract falls off of that wine by virtue of something totally un-American, which is patience in the cellar, do you think that a 5 to 7 year old 16% Zin can still be in balance?
And I can only speak from my experience. I mean, I've got every wine in my cellar that I've made since 76. At least a case with two exceptions, and those I've got 8 and 9 bottles respectively. Every Cabernet I've ever made. And I found pretty much balance in, balance out. Zinfandel and older Viogniers, again, because they tend to be higher alcohol, and the first thing that a wine typically loses is fruit. And when the fruit goes down, the alcohol does come forward. Right? So I found that, and I've got Viognier back to 92 and Zin is back into way back, and I found that, with rare exception, you get a 10-year-old Zinfandel or 8-year-old Viognier with high alcohol, they're not going to be nearly as attractive as they were when they were younger.
Yep. And I've found that alcohol in wine, I mean, it can be semi-preservative if the wine is in balance, and I could not agree with you more. I remember talking to Brian Babcock, who taught me how to make wine professionally back in 1996 when I worked for Babcock for a harvest, and he said two things that I'll never forget. One, well, he said a lot of things. Number one was, that when someone says, oh, this wine needs to come into balance, it's a little hard or a little awkward or a little angular, that is not, chances are, that's a selling point, not a qualitative point. Like, if I tell you this wine's going to come around in 3 years, I'm trying to sell you wine. But we probably know, and I agree with Brian saying, the grapes have to be perfect. They have to taste delicious in the fermenter. They have to taste delicious during fermentation. They have to smell like blueberry pie. And then when they're done, they have to be delicious out of the press, delicious in the tank, delicious on barreling down. And then every time you taste them, he says, the greatest wines I've ever tasted have never been out of whack. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I go back, this was, you know, Ralph Kunke and Dr. Amory and Old Cherry Cheeks when I was at Davis. And it was like the whole department. They said, as a rule, it's balance in, balance out. If you put a wine in the bottle, unbalanced for whatever reason, don't expect Mother Nature, and there are always exceptions to that, but don't expect Mother Nature to make your wine better if you hold it for 10 years in a proper cellar. If it's balanced, it has to be balanced in to get it balanced out. Now, it doesn't mean, if it's balanced in, doesn't mean that in 20 years it's still going to be a good wine. But it's got a much better chance.
Here's the $25 million question. I've had wines that are in balance as young wines. Pinot Noirs from the Santa Rita Hills, maybe from like Brewer, let's just take Brewer Clifton, 16.2%, full 100% stem included, 16.2% Pinot Noir, at release, balanced. I've had wines 14.8 at release, unbalanced. So it's not a numbers game. What do you think? I mean, we can't just say any wine over 15% alcohol is hot, because certainly they aren't. How does this
work? Well, I mean, you know, you're looking, no matter what we say or do, wine is, you know, from the time we put a cork in it, it's still a living thing. I mean, particularly, you know, your reds, you've got, you know, you got your beasts in there. You have so many phenolic compounds. You know, people say, well, geez, this wine didn't have any sediment in it when you bottled it. But those, well, hey, you get just right. You know, we can measure to the parts per million the amount of oxygen we put under the cork. You know that.
Yeah.
The amount of oxygen with the phenolic compounds and the alcohols and the there's 8 organic acids and all of the different. I mean, every wine, every fermented beverage has every alcohol that is liquid at you know, room temperature. I mean, you've got isopropyl and, you know, pentanol and hexane. And there's all this stuff that's going on, and they start condensing, and there's a constant change. Wine is a living thing. Reds especially, my basic philosophy in life has always been a wine's first responsibility is to be red.
That was Terry Waugh, 1954, the first responsibility.
Oh, really? I thought it was mine.
No, and then the second, you know what the second responsibility from Harry Waugh's quote? Second responsibility is it's burgundy.
Oh, okay. No, my first rule is if you like it, it's good wine.
Yes.
And second, the wine's first responsibility is to be red. I mean, I left, Charity Hospital in New Orleans, the doctoral program, to come to California to make wine, chasing Cabernet. Oh, actually, I was chasing Bordeaux's, because in New Orleans in 1970-71, the only wine was French. Yeah. Maybe a jug of Parmesan or something.
On Wednesday, I did a full hour show on my show, in defense of white wine, and I did everything I could for almost an hour to basically explain why white wine was better quality to price ratio and how white wine is more expressive early in the way that Americans drink wine. If we are in a culture where 90% of the wines are consumed within 48 hours of purchase, no red wines are being consumed at maturity, and as a result, none of the red wines are reaching a level of expressiveness that really show vineyard character the same way that white wines do. How about alcohol and whites versus reds?
I mean, we try to keep, actually, you know, there are always exceptions in Zinfandel just because of the way it ripens. I mean, it's the pex bad boy of grapes in the vineyard. we try to keep our alcohol, particularly with the new yeast, you know, in the mid-13s. And I think that's, you know, what we try to do. But I mean, you're right, Wes. You know, I would tell people, if somebody buys a bottle of wine on Friday afternoon, if it's still in the house Monday morning, there's been a death or a divorce.
Mm.
And one of the things, Mr. Mondavi, and I've been very fortunate in that between Joe Paterno and Robert Mondavi and somebody you don't know, I've had three people that really helped me. And one of the things, Mr. Mondavi, and I remember this day because he used to sit up front of his winery and do the bullshit that I do. And he said, always make sure you've got a library and you cellar it well, because you're going to have people that are going to want to come down and say, you know, it's my son's 40th birthday. He was born in 1985 or whatever. I mean, and I want a wine. Not a problem. You're not going to get it for the same price I was selling it in 85, but I've got it. And there's, like I said, I can pull up every vintage of Cabernet since 76, and most of them in large bottle formats also. But that's something Mr. Mondavi used to stress.
Now, if I had and shared what we have today, when you were talking about white and red and the like, and here's, we've got Eberle Viognier in 18 and 18 J. Wilkes Viognier as well. Then a Cabernet Sauvignon 17 from Eberle, and then a 16 J. Wilkes Highlands District Zinfandel. When we were talking about alcohol and this conversation, we were wanting to put forth things that maybe were a little different than, say, maybe what people are normally used to, or at least that mystique of what Paso is. Because when we travel around and we're talking about Paso, and I'm sure you guys have seen this too, especially over the years with you, Gary, running and being a Paso advocate, is that instantly people write Paso off as being high alcohol wines or maybe hot wines. And in my time at the Alliance now, promoting Paso Robles, I've definitely seen a decline in that. I definitely have seen how people are now taking our wines more seriously. And we have that, we showed that older bottle that was 12.6. So it wasn't always like that. There was just be a few bad eggs or something like that out there.
No, I mean, if you look at my wines from the 70s and up through the 80s, I don't think you'd find anything over a 13.5. Mm-hmm. And when I was wine, I mean, I quit being a winemaker in 97 was my last vintage as the winemaker at Eberle, although I still kibitz a bit. But, you know, the evolution of the new yeast has allowed, you know, just naturally. And you say, well, why do you do that? Well, you know, you're using this yeast and this yeast, and each of them give a slightly different character to a wine. And most of them are very nice. You know, a lot of these are coming out of Geisenheim in Germany and the Pasteur Institute. And, you know, modern genetic technology in yeast cultures is unbelievable. And like I said, what we had available to us in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, it's like the Lamborghini versus the Conestoga wagon. It's made a tremendous, and not just that, but there's so much that the industry has changed in the last 50 years that I've been involved in it, that it, you know, and I mean, for the better. I think, you know, this is, you know, so far, this is, you know, sort of the glory years of the industry. I mean, it's amazing. I remember when we used to judge wines. I've been judging wines forever and ever. And I remember in the 80s and the 90s, you know, you'd get a panel of
four. Lemonade.
Yeah. No, it was like, you know, you look at Dick Peterson's, and you would sit there and you would take, somebody put 10 wines in front of you, three or four of them, all you had to do is, oh, And you moved it back and moved it back and moved it
Gary,
back.
Gary, what does DNPIM stand for?
Do not put in mouth.
That is the worst note a wine judge can make. That means that they didn't even put that wine anywhere near their mouth, that it smelled so damn bad.
Yeah, I mean, there were four out of 10 wines, you could just say, okay, that's not even a gimme bronze. I mean, that's a bad wine. Today, you sit down to 10 wines at these competitions, and even when you're judging, you know, relatively inexpensive wines, they're sound. They, you know, they may not be your idea of the best wine, but they're sound. They're not loaded with mercaptan or hydrogen sulfide. I mean, it's amazing. The overall quality, and I don't mean just California or the United States, but the world has gotten so much better. I remember, you know, drinking wines, and I'm fortunate, you know, you're in this industry, you get to drink a lot of old, neat things. But I remember the Burgundies from the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, I'm coming out of Davis, and, you know, you've been introduced throughout the country, and, hey, this is Britannomyces, you know, and you'd open up these old Burgundies. And, I mean, you expect today, I mean, if I have a little Britannomyces in the Burgundy, I expect it. I mean, if it was in a California wine, it's going to be written down. But in France, that's sort of, but there were one, they were so overwhelming in Britannomyces spoilage. I'm going, how did people think these were great bottles of wine? And I was always amazed when I saw some of the, you know, the really famous wine writers of the time writing about, oh, the 50s and the 60s, the Burgundy. I'm going, oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, I would say that the new world has given the old world the opportunity to clean up their cellars, to use ozone machines and cross flow filtration and some of the amazing technology that's become popular. I like to look back at 2008 and say, what I recognize as a wine judge that's judged a lot of the same competitions you have, Gary, is that wines after the 2008 vintage changed substantially. Because of the world's financial situation, I just think every bad winemaker got their ass fired. every person that was making substandard wine realized that it wasn't the vineyards, it was the chef. And that we have now come to this moment in 2020 where there's more financial difficulties because of the pandemic, but also we are in the golden age. Even before 2020, we were in the golden age. There has never been a time in the history of the world where wine hasn't been of higher quality and least price. I will argue that any bottle around $10 currently is better than the wines that were being consumed by the dukes and the duchesses, the kings and the queens of Europe in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century.
No question.
Yeah. Winos under a bridge are drinking better wines than kings did 200 years ago. So
that's why you've seen me under the bridge a lot.
That's it. I knew you were a troll. I just knew it. No, but you know, it's just a matter of, wow, are we lucky to be living in a time where we can travel the world in a glass? We can do 150 countries, you know, in the next year for under $20 a night, and we can travel to those places and taste the actual flavor of liquid culture, which I think is just so important.
Hey guys, I've got somebody asking a question, and I think instead of just, you know, doing the question and that's it, I'm going to promote them to a panelist. And it's someone that you guys know and actually from the Cork Dorks, the Cork Dorks radio program.
Okay, so let me say, you have 1% you can mess with as far as the ABV. Have you ever heard or experienced the TTB audit or fact check a winery on their ABV? And are there ever decisions made in the cellar that would move one to want to do something either directly or just fudge the ABV a bit to make it more appealing to the market? And if so, are these decisions for the consumer? Maybe hypothetically they're for the scorer, the wine buyer? I would love both of you guys to chime in on that.
Well, you know, it used to be 1.5% variable. You could go up or down. And as a rule, and it was really, at that time, it was VATF. And they weren't really concerned about it until you got up to like 13.8, 13.9. Then they wanted to make sure, because once you hit the 14, you got bumped into the bonus round as far as taxes. And they were very, very conscious of those lines. When you stepped, when you hit 14, your tax went up about, actually about five times what it was under at table wine. And that was, but I have not had a wine audited in 2 decades, so I don't know. I would say they've sort of walked away from it because so many wines were up. And we just, you know, I mean, we put to the 10th what our alcohol is on the label, and if we pay the higher tax, which we just figured part of doing business, if we get something over 14.
Yes, I'm going to go ahead and agree. First of all, I have heard of audits, but I've heard that the only place that they pull bottles is from supermarket shelves because they're kind of lazy. So they'll go into a supermarket, grab 7 bottles and take them back and run them through a meviometer, look at the alcohol level, make sure it's within the legal realm, and boom, you're fine. I don't think the TTB has enough time or people to be really doing that. And I heard about that back in the late 90s and maybe early 2000s and haven't heard anything since. So, you know, and I think that 14% is amazing. One thing about the Miller family that I'm really, really proud of is we have our own internal lab. We have 3 or 4 people working in our lab, and we're constantly testing our alcohol levels and reporting them absolutely accurately, the same way that we're doing the 0.1. And you know it because you can, I'm going to teach each and every one of the people watching how to tell whether a winery fudges their wine labels. If you see 13.7 to 13.9 constantly, and you never see a 14 or 14.1 or 14.2, you might see a 14.8, you might see a 15.2, but it's never between 14 and 14.5. They're probably fudging because the yeasts are getting more. The yeast today, and I'm not being ageist, but they have changed. We're getting a transition or a conversion rate of about 0.5 to 0.55 between the level of sugar in the wine. So if the wine comes in at 20% sugar or 20 Brix, back in the day it would come in at 10% alcohol. You use a modern yeast today at 20 Brix, you're going to get 12% alcohol. How the hell is that possible? Because Scott Labs and Y Yeast and all these other places are making the most incredibly efficient yeast they possibly can. So when I call Scott Labs and they say, hey, how can I help you? I'm like, do you have any lazy yeast? I'm like, I want a yeast with a 0.5 conversion rate. They're like, in 20 years, we have never heard one caller ask for this.
Yeah. And you know, the one place where we must be accurate, because we sell, we're almost at 30,000 cases. We've tried to be there for the last 5 years. But we sell in 28 states and 3 countries in Europe. And when we go to Europe, it must be accurate. I mean, they won't accept the bibliometer. It has to come from a wine lab, and man, it's got to be right on. Because if you send it to Switzerland or to Denmark or anything, and it's not right, man, you got yourself a real problem.
Is something that's fudging, or are they doing it for the wine buyer? Or the consumer probably doesn't care, right? Or is it for the psalm? Or
I have no. I mean, you know, it's the law. It's just the law. And the other thing is, particularly, now Switzerland is nice. I mean, I love Switzerland's in my top 10 markets for the last 25 years. We've got a great distributor there. But the EU, when the EU went in and the different laws and the French and the Italians and the Spanish made the whole EU, you know, the same laws uniform. It created a problem. They don't want our wine over there. I mean, and I can understand that. I mean, it's, you know, we accept wines in here with essentially no tariffs, but when we go to Europe, it's one of the things we're still, our wines are tariff. And it's just another way, it's another add-on that we have to pay, you know, in the lab to make sure, because we don't want. Trust me, I've had situations, well, hey, you said it was 12.8 and it was really a 13 and we can't, this wine is in quarantine and what are you going to do about it? You need to send other labels over. Seriously. So, but that's law, just silly laws. And then they're old.
I don't know.
Worry about it anymore.
There's an interesting question on that I thought maybe the. Oh, I'm sorry. Wes, are you going to answer?
Well, I'm trying to think about why people fudge their alcohol labels. You're talking to two people that are going on the basically saying, challenging the world, try to find one wine from Jay Welch or from Everly that's not within 0.1 of the actual alcohol. So you might be talking to the wrong people. I'm trying to put myself in the position of thinking, A, it would be to save tax money. If money's tight in a month, you might want to say 13.7 instead of 14.3. You're going to save yourself a hell of a lot of taxes. You're sending the wine to Letty Teague. Maybe you want to have a lower alcohol on the wine. Maybe you want to appeal to a European audience. Maybe you're looking to increase your exports to Europe or to other places that are more amenable to the European palate and a little more delicacy and elegance. But in the end, I think it's our responsibility as winemakers to be scientific and to give people accurate scientific information about the wine. It's on the label, and it's basically saying this is what we are declaring to the world about the truth of our wine. And if it's not truthful, I think maybe you should find a producer that trusts you as a consumer a little bit more to understand the actual alcohol within the wine.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, we've got an interesting question that I'm going to kind of modify a little bit here. And it's basically asking about native yeast and how we're talking about commercial yeasts. However, where I would like to take that is they ask what the prevalence of one type over the other is. But I think modifying that question would be native yeast. Using that, how much are you really rolling the dice then at the end of the day as far as what ABV is going to come and kind of turn out to be? Or is it at this point in time, native yeast is just it's still working and it's still doing what it needs to do?
If you're going to use native yeast and you're going to roll the dice, if you go to Vegas, you're going to be a loser. The native yeast, I'm always amazed at guys who get into this business as home winemakers or everything, and they look, it's romantic to you. I'm sorry. Our whole industry, there's so much bullshit in our industry. And native yeasts, yeah. I mean, our ancestors got drunk on native yeast, and it wasn't what they got in the when they were fermenting. It was the fruit that hit the ground and started fermenting, and, they would come along. It's just like the cedar waxwings eating the entire Canterbury's and then getting drunk and falling out of the trees. Hey, there's alcohol there. But native yeast will create alcohol, but they create a whole lot of other things that you don't want in your wine.
And I'm going to
and anybody that's using native yeast, in my opinion, and I know some people that swear by it, I think they are severely brain damaged.
Dame Bramage? Well, let me go off on Dame Bramage for a little bit. First of all, there's no such thing as native yeast. Everything is barrel, and everything comes from the gut of a wasp. A couple of Italian scientists have just discovered that how yeast overwinters, because yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, will not actually overwinter in a normal cold environment. So they found that it's actually overwintering in the gut of specific wasps and yellow jackets. And these yellow jackets move into the vineyard and spread this yeast. Every yellow jacket on the planet Earth is born with Saccharomyces cerevisiae in its gut. And this is really, really interesting stuff. So these bees are moving these yeasts around. Where do the yeasts come from? Well, they could have been truly native. But what I'm going to suggest is when anyone says native yeast, I would suggest you say, don't you mean feral? What we're getting is whatever yeast is in the environment. Is it Saccharomyces cerevisiae from California? Probably not. Is it Saccharomyces cerevisiae at all? If you are allowing the native yeast in the feral or native yeast in your winery to complete fermentation, if you've ever used Saccharomyces byanus, or Konkani or any of the other yeasts that are far more aggressive than Cervasi, well, you have just, whatever yeast you have used in your winery that is the most aggressive yeast you've ever worked, that's what's going to ferment your wine, not what came in from the vineyard. If you want to use some idea, some romantic idea that the wine, the grapes come in with these beautiful native yeasts on the skins, which is true because the bloom of the grapes will attract yeast because of a sort of an ionic charge. But it's not that. It's whatever is in the winery. So if you've ever used a Bienis yeast, that's what's going to take over your winery. So
that,
I believe that letting a fermentation start on whatever yeast is in the winery is fine, but then once I start seeing it starting to warm up, I'm going to inoculate with whatever yeast I think is going to make the most beautifully, commercially acceptable product. Because my job is not to reinvent the wheel. My job is to provide the wine for people at table.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracaena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracaenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank.
But you know, the real exception to the native yeast, and this I think is almost legit. So you go into Burgundy and Bordeaux and the old Italian and Spanish vineyards, where when people would make their wine and they would work and work and work with the yeast and something that would eventually overwhelm and become. But they would take their pumice and they would spread it out through the vineyard. And eventually the farro yeast was actually this yeast that they had been using for, you know, 10 decades or a century, and had been, you know, it became the dominant yeast, yeah, which was good. In the new world, we spread our pumice into vineyard every 5 years because we don't have enough, and we stockpile it until you get enough where you can justify putting loads and loads of it into a manure spreader and spread it through the vineyards. But at that time we're spreading, you know, 25 different yeasts. So we inoculate big time. We want, when Chris says, I want, this is what I'm trying to do with this lot, this is what I want to do here, boom. You know, when I made Muscat, you know, back in the 70s, I used Epernay too. I mean, it was a cold tolerant yeast because we could ferment at 49 degrees and it keep popping. Now Chris says, I say, are you using Epernay too? He says, oh man, no, I got 3 different lots, I got 3 different yeasts, and they all add a little of this.
Interested in using different yeasts because instead of making traditional blends, we generally make varietal wines. So we want to look for ways that we can get complexity out of a single varietal, out of a single vineyard.
Sure. Yeah. And it, you know, the other thing is too, is that, you know, when we started our industry in the new world, I'm talking, you know, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, South America, you know, the United States, Europe had a tradition that went back centuries. millennia. And, you know, what did we have to offer? How could we improve? And the thing was, there's so many, and I remember the, traveling in Europe in the early 70s, and I was appalled at the wineries and how dirty and ancient and run down. I mean, the equipment, I was going, man, I wouldn't pump water with that pump, let alone wine. In the new world, we were very fortunate, and most of our technology came out of Germany and Italy, but we benefited from having new wineries and the new technology and the new science that the industry, and now you can't tell the difference between, you know, the new European and the new the new world wineries. Yeah. They've adapted that, and they've picked up on a lot of the science.
So we've got a question from Facebook Live. It says, in British Columbia, brewers are making many types of barley wine, some as high as 11.5% ABV. They want your opinion on them using the term wine in their marketing strategy because they think they're just strong beers.
I could really care less how beers. I drink a hell of a lot of beer. I'm a huge beer fanatic. I travel all over the United States tasting beer from Treehouse all the way down to, you know, in Boston, all the way down to San Diego. Damn, we are in another golden age of beer, and American craft beer is basically changing the world of beer anyways. And so I have absolutely no problem in whatever you want to call your alcoholic beverage, if you want to include the word wine on it. I get it. I'm barley. It's going to happen.
You can call anything wine as long as you say it's barley wine. Or up in Alaska, there was a guy making wine out of milk. Tedeschi over in Hawaii making pineapple wine. But if you just say wine, it has to be grapes.
Although I wish they would call sake rice beer, because it really is not rice wine. And feral yeast, again, I think in Belgian beer and as well as in sake, that really runs the show. So that was what I wanted to integrate. But yes, I have no problem with any beer that makes me happy.
We had an interesting conversation choosing these wines and why, and I thought now we can maybe transition into talking a little bit about the wines that we're having. And I'm sorry, everyone at home, that you're not enjoying these amazing wines right now with us. But with this particular topic, I was hoping that both Wes and Gary would be able to talk a little bit about these wines and why they were chosen for this very specific subject of alcohol. We have the Everly once again. Actually, I'll just pull up the picture. But maybe, Wes, would you like to kind of start talking a little bit about it? And I'll pull the picture up of the wines that we have.
Yeah, so I brought the 2018 J. Wilkes Viognier Paso Robles Highlands District, as well as the 2016 J. Wilkes Paso Robles Highlands District Zinfandel. Paso Robles Highlands District is one of the 12 AVAs that were sort of approved simultaneously in the southeast corner of the Paso Robles, sort of, it almost kind of looks like a map of Texas. So if you can imagine sort of East Texas and down sort of, you know, it kind of is in that kind of position. Highest average elevation of any of the 12 specific micro AVAs within Paso. It has one of the highest diurnal shifts of any area in Paso. So hot days, cold nights, the average diurnal shift is 55.0 degrees, which is the highest diurnal shift of any AVA that I know of in the United States. What I wanted to do is bring wines that show that I don't have a horse in the race. I wanted to bring the highest alcohol white I have ever made, and that is, there it is. The highest alcohol white I've ever made as a professional winemaker in the last 20 years is the wine in my glass. It's 15.2% alcohol. It had nothing to do with me trying to posit a style upon the wine. It was a matter of me as 20 years as a professional vineyard manager and viticulturist walking into that field and asking myself, at what perfect moment can I capture these grapes? Because the moment you pick the grapes, I'm not really into being a hands-on winemaker. I want to let the place really show through the wine.
So we picked this wine around 25 bricks, and at 25 bricks, the conversion rate we got to a dry wine ended up at 15.2 alcohol. I also have a very, very strong belief that if you are going to adjust a wine, it has to be done as juice and never wine. And we made the decision early on not to adjust anything in the wine, no water adds, no acid adds. So the wine ended up around 6 grams of titratable acidity and about 3.35 pH, which has plenty of acidity, plenty of burr, plenty of cut, plenty of liveliness. And the alcohol just ended up being pretty, pretty high to get the VNA where we thought the fruit was phenolically ripe. On the other hand, in 2016, even though 2018 was a cooler vintage probably, 2016, the Zinfandel came in at 22.8 ripe. The skins were pliant. We're starting to see even a little tiny bit of, I've never really seen any dimpling at around 23 bricks, but we were seeing really, really ripe flavors and great kind of a ratio of flavor to sugar level. So we pulled the trigger at 22.8, and we ended up with making a Paso Zin. Is it possible under 14% alcohol? We certainly did not 13.9 to save some money on taxes. We said 13.9 because that's the actual alcohol in this wine. And I love the fact that it has no raisiny character. It has no porty character. It's all about, like, if I was going to use this wine in a class, I would say, you want to know what raspberry esters smell like in Zinfandel? Open this bottle and check it out, because I am absolutely and totally stoked. And the wine won a gold medal at the Orange County Commercial Wine Competition, which I'm very, very proud of.
Wes, how do you check? You weren't judging there, right?
Good raspberry.
I wasn't a judge, and I don't know if I knew my own wine, but, you know. They try not to put your own wines on your panels, but sometimes you get them in the sweepstakes rounds, and you never know which wines are yours. If you want to be humbled in your palate, try to figure out which wines are yours in a lineup, and very commonly you will fail.
It's hideous. I mean, I've judged, I'd say in a typical year when I was really doing the most, I'd do about 10 competitions a year. And I've judged a lot of my wines, and I've been able to pick out my wines out of maybe 1,000 competitions 4 times where I knew. I mean, there have been times I say, hey, that could be my wine, but that could be my wine. And that one sort of looks like that. But 4 times I've done it.
Yeah, for me, it will always be like
Grenache. They all got goals.
Very well done. But yeah, it'll be like Grenache Blanc. 3 Grenache Blancs, and you know you didn't actually run yours through.
Hey, when I was back in the 70s when I was making Syrah in Orange County, Syrah, you know, class of one. Oh, man, that's a gold medal wine.
Oh, my goodness, more people should be using this gorgeous varietal.
Adam, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering, because, you know, Zinfandel ripens unevenly, and on the same cluster you can have, you know, raisins, you can have green berries. What berries are you checking the bricks at to make sure it's ready to pick? The ones that are perfect?
I do cluster samples.
Okay. And Zinfandel, you have to do cluster samples.
I do a 15 to 20 pound sample on everything that I do. And the way that I do it, I have a proprietary method where I choose a random number between 5 and 13, and I go that many rows, that many vines in, and that many clusters in. So 5 rows in, 5 vines in, 5 clusters in, pick a cluster, then turn and go to the adjacent row and choose a cluster that balances the cluster I chose. Then choose a random one, and then choose a cluster that balances the cluster I chose. And I do this until I have most of an entire, you know, Homer bucket full of grapes, go back, crush it, let it soak overnight with a little potassium metabisulfite, and then test that juice as it's soaked up for the red grapes. And with the white grapes, I would test that. And the key is Guinn or any other grape, Nebbiolo, Dolcetto, Barbera, that has big-ass clusters. You really do need to use the whole cluster because the problem is that one berry on that cluster is 19 bricks, and one cluster on that on that one berry on that cluster is 25. It looks like 22, but you'll get all the shrill acid from the 18, and you'll get the overripe flavor. So the hobgoblin of the production of the best wines in the world is uniformity of ripeness from the top of the cluster to the bottom of the cluster, which is one of the hardest things to do in the art of viticulture.
The only reason that Zinfandel succeeds as well as it does in California is we have no humidity. Because you get just a hint of humidity, a little bit of water, Zinfandel just rots.
Sour rot.
Chile and California are, I mean, it's like, it's the only place that's really going to do well. And unfortunately, it's one of those things. You know, there are varieties like Chenin Blanc and some other varieties that you don't want to plant past Rosas. But certainly Zinfandel, California is, I would say, very fortunate in that. And, you know, and it had, you go back to the gold rush days, you know, one of the reasons that Zinfandel became so popular, it throws a big crop, it throws a second crop when the first crop is frosted, and it throws a tertiary crop when the second crop is frosted. And the tertiary crop is the best balanced, you know, I mean, because Zinfandel will hang more fruit than even the trellis can support, let alone the vines. So many problems.
Gary, yeah, talk about your Viognier and talk about the Cab, which is basically like, you know, the flagship of the Everwood Wines.
Yeah, well, you know, we're very fortunate in that for a winery of our size, you know, close to 30,000 cases, we, in the last 5 years, I don't think we've had a single wine that we had 12 months supply of. So everything, like right now, the 2017 Cab, is we're pushing it. I mean, we'd like to have it through the end of the summer. And it will get to the point where Stacy won't get any of it for wholesale at all. And it'll be strictly a tasting room item, you know, because that's where you want to sell your wine is in the tasting room. But, you know, I would say at any given time, like right now, if you go into our tasting room, we have a sheet, people are buying wines all the time coming up in the parking lot. We got maybe 9 wines. Well, we've got, in reality, about 15 wines that we make. But, you know, they go so fast. Cabernet, like I said, when I left Louisiana, I came to Davis to learn how to make Cabernet. And it was so crazy. I was a national science fellow, one of very few in the United States, the only one in Louisiana at that time. And, you know, my whole background was science. And I had never seen a winery except in pictures. And I picked up, and my professors couldn't believe it because I published a couple of papers in genetics and journals. And I said, no, I don't want to be a geneticist. I want to be an alcoholic. And I went to Davis and never looked back. I mean, it's the single best decision I've ever made in my life. Well, there was this girl, Kyo, back at Penn State.
Gary. So one of the other kind of topics of this whole thing about alcohol has also been kind of how people make buying decisions, right? People, maybe they're making those buying decisions because they want a lower alcohol wine. And I guess where I'm going with this is, and this is something that Wes and I kind of talked about as far as these buying decisions, that it, how do we help a consumer maybe understand that just because the number might be high, that they need to take a little bit more time than in understanding the wine better? How do we do that in our industry? How are we trying to impart that kind of information?
Well, I'm thinking about confusion, and I'm thinking the most confusing labels in the world are German Riesling. So the German Riesling folks are trying to make labels that show a bar graph with a continuum to say level of acid, level of sugar, level, you know, different levels. So the question is, how are we serving the consumers by giving an exact percentage down to, you know, 0.1 of the alcohol by volume in this wine? Now, you don't have – I don't know if the label laws are the same, but when I was growing up, you didn't even have to put the alcohol on the label if you just labeled it as table wine. The problem was if you label it as table wine, it's considered an inferior product. So what if we offered American winemakers an option to classify our wines by alcohol level, say, I don't know, you know, 10 to 12, 12 to 13.5, 13.5 to 15, and 15 and above. Would that give them, if there was just a terminology, I mean, you know, just some like, some term for the wine that would recognize, you know, the wine would be like, you know, low ripeness, moderate ripeness, high ripeness, instead of giving a percentage of sugar, and maybe somehow make a symbol for it. I don't know. I don't know, Gary. What do you think?
I mean, I've had wines that were under 13 alcohol, and you taste them, and they're just hotter than hell. They've been on your things with a lot of pressed wine, a lot of phenolics, and those when their phenolics are young, they're single, short chained phenol rings, and they're hot. You know, with age, when they condense and form longer chains, some of the old Burgundies would actually become almost macroscopic, and it gives you that silky sensation. But you know, a wine can be low in alcohol and very high in phenolics, and it's still, you think it's high in alcohol, but it's really the phenols that are hot in your mouth. I think, you know, I mean, there's so many damn different variables in wine, the organics and the organic chemistry that is going on in a living product. I think it's difficult to try to put on a label what this wine is because in 6 months, it's not that wine. It's a different product. I think, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever, you know, one of the things that I find so exciting about wine, particularly wines, you know, like the good red wines, is the way that they do change in the bottle. And even in your wine glass, I mean, you take a good Cabernet and you put it in a glass and you taste it and you set it aside for 15 minutes and you come back, it's different. And in another 15 minutes, it's different again. You know, some of the exceptions, a well-made Zinfandel, you know, Zinfandel that we just said, oh my God, you get the raspberries in there. Oh. Zinfandel comes back every 15 minutes like a ball-peen hammer between the eyes. It's raspberry. Bang! Or Cabernet, Syrah, Pinot Noir, they change so dramatically in the glass, Cabernet especially.
Now, here's, you know, in the sense that wine is constantly changing, is the fact that wine is intellectual, wine is difficult, wine is complicated, if we are trying to simplify it for a customer or for a certain cohort in the market, are we taking away the opportunity for experimentation and discovery? And I feel, as sort of a self-proclaimed intellectual, because no one else will proclaim it, that wine is it's my search. It's me looking. It's me experimenting. Part of me wants to say, no one needs to explain wine. If you want to jump in with us and have some fun. I guess the question is, at what point are people responsible for their own wine education and understanding what their palate wants and what numbers on the label might influence those decisions?
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, like I said, you know, earlier, my two rules in winemaking. Number one is drink what you like. Don't let an expert or a winemaker tell you what you like. I mean, every American knows what their favorite soft drink is, what their favorite beer is, what their favorite hamburger joint is, what they, you know, I mean, the best, you know, love you. You have your taste. Why do you need an expert to tell you what you like in wine? Our industry has been dominated, I think, too long by people that try to make you think that what they like is what you should like. If you like it, drink it. If you don't like it, don't. If you want to have a good German, you know, qualitative wine, Riesling, with a great steak, go right ahead. I just don't want to come to your house for dinner. But But don't be, you know, there's so damn many rules. It's a beverage. It's something you are going to rent for 5 or 6 hours. You're going to take Cabernet and convert it to Chardonnay in about 6 hours. Don't be intimidated. It's a beverage. It's something that makes life easier. It makes mother-in-laws palatable.
And with that, so I want to thank guests today, Wes Hagen with J. Wilkes Wines. Thank you so much, Wes. Kip, really, Everly Winery. Gary, thank you. And Adam Montiel.
Yeah, baby. Great job, guys. It was so nice and fun to be here. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Happy to you.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, slàinte!